I think so, yeah. When you're done introducing, can I like just add a bit about the audio side of things?
Yeah, definitely, definitely.
Thanks.
Hi, everybody.
Hi.
Thanks for joining this group, and thanks again for being willing to be recorded. So my name's Jillian. I am going to be just facilitating the post-panel discussion. I'm an Apano volunteer, long-term volunteer. I've been with them for about 2.5 years, and just got involved. They did a workshop at my school when I was in college, and that's how I heard about them. They were only about 1.5 people back then, and now, as you know, like Apano has grown a ton. So the discussion is just going to be popcorn style. So if you have anything to input, just feel free to speak up. And similarly, also, we do want to make sure that we are adhering to the group agreements. Again, those were to stay engaged, but also to take care of yourself, assume best intentions, but also own your impacts, take space and make space, or that step up, step back thing, listen for understanding, and expect and accept lack of closure. So my role today is to offer some questions and to just guide a discussion that provides you space to really just reflect on all the comments in the panel that we just heard tonight. It's not necessarily intended to be a debate on the sentencing of Peter Liang. We know that we may not all walk away from this discussion in perfect agreement, and there's not always closure to this, but we really just want to make space to have a dialogue around a topic that we might not always make time to make space for, and perhaps this will also spark some deeper and further continued discussions. So that is kind of my introduction.
Okay. If you want. Great. Hi again, everyone. For those of you who didn't see me kind of awkwardly waving in the front, or if we haven't met, my name is Alan Montesilio. I'm helping Dimae Roberts. The reason why I'm here with this recorder is that I'm helping her put together a series of oral history recordings. So I'm going to, you know, my role is to kind of strike this awkward balance between, you know, wanting to get the best recordings I can and not being too intrusive to try to disrupt the flow of a conversation. But for the sake of me getting the best audio I can, I want to like add on a few little additional agreements to the ones that Jillian introduced. One, since this would be on the radio, maybe the first time you speak, could you just say your name before making your comment or question? The second thing is maybe just to make it a bit easier, if someone's speaking and you have the thought to maybe jump in, maybe you can signal to me and I can try to get to you with my mic while you're talking. It's also much easier for me and for the recording if you don't interrupt when someone else is talking. And if you could too, you know, if you're responding to someone's point, you know, it doesn't always feel natural, but as best you can, maybe, you know, include the gist of that point in your comment. Because if you just say, no, I don't agree, I mean, that's fine. You know, not everything has to be perfect for the radio, but it makes it a little bit easier on my end. And if you have any questions about me sort of hopping around and poking my microphone around, just let me know. But thank you all for being willing to be recorded. I appreciate it. And I'll be kind of like, as people talk, kind of doing this to,
yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. So are we all ready to get started then? Okay, so I guess just to get us started, does anybody have any comments or reflections from the different things that were said in the panel tonight? Anything that just resonated with you, or just notes that you want to reflect on?
Hi, I'm Trina Hing. I think that is a pretty tall order, but I'm really glad that the discussion is being started. The collaboration between either the API community as well as the African-American community, it's going to be, I think we should start now. But I don't foresee any great changes for a long time. Mm-hmm. But at least we're starting.
If you don't mind me asking, sorry, if I can maybe follow up a little bit, like when you say you don't see any changes for a long time, what makes you say that?
It's a new concept. I think that there's got to be willingness for all people in both communities. And knowing the Chinese community, that's a tall order for just trying to rally them and change their thinking. And because we have different generations, at least 3-4 generations of Chinese here, the immigrants all the way to the third generation. It's not so much the younger generation, it's the older generation that you will need to convince to change your attitudes. Because they're very, kind of self-contained, stuck up. Not stuck up, but, you know, they just have their own set of values and attitudes.
So I'd like to add to that. This is Jenny Chu. About the Chinese community, I was raised by two immigrant parents that immigrated over from Hong Kong and Saigon, Vietnam. And I often think when we're talking about barriers and trying to get people on the right page about helping each other and solidarity, that we forget that immigrant communities are dealing with a lot of trauma and are also dealing with surviving and dealing with trying to make a living, and asking them to work for peace and justice for another community can oftentimes feel like an extremely tall order, like what Trina said. So I'd like to, I don't know how to get past that, but I'd like to figure out ways to talk about it where it doesn't feel like another thing against working against their survival.
I'm Julia Withers, and yeah, I wanted to build off your point about, like, there's already so many obstacles and hardships that, like, the API community goes through, especially, like, newer immigrants. And I was thinking that just, like, having, if we build from, like, the most, like, group that faces the most suffering, then we will all be free, like we were talking about earlier in the panel. Like, we're not free till we're all free, and so by working for those freedoms for everyone, then we all benefit. But yeah, I totally see your point. I think that's a really tough decision, especially when, well, for example, I'm like second or third generation. I'm not sure. It's counted differently sometimes. But like, I don't know any of the suffering that my grandparents went through when they immigrated here. And I basically am riding on all of the hard work and sacrifices they made. So it's like, I'm pretty separate. I have a degree of separation from their suffering. And so I feel like super fired up about, fighting anti-blackness, but my grandparents, for example, yeah, I can't communicate with them. Like, I have a language barrier, and so I don't really know how to do that, but I also know they're pretty anti-black. They hold a lot of anti-black feelings. So that's, like, a hard place for me. And my mom only knows, like, sixth grade level Cantonese, and so she can't even really translate for me. So that's a challenge.
June Reyes. So, like, in thinking about this, you know, Peter Liang versus, I guess, and a Kai Gurley, and, you know, I'm not Chinese, but I am Asian, and sort of when we were talking about race is sort of this more of this, like, it's not biological, you know, it's really how we've been grouped by, you know, the folks who founded this country, white people. And so thinking about that, you know, I'm like, you know, getting lumped into being Asian and thinking about, you know, the Chinese community and what's kind of reflected amongst all the other Asian communities when we have this sort of division. And so what is the role of other Asians who kind of get pulled into those same stereotypes together? And so there's sort of that division as well of like, okay, well then how do we come together? And we always, and I always feel like, you know, in these discussions, it's like, oh yeah, APIs, but talk about Pacific Islanders and our struggles are also very different and similar. And so, so that kind of has got me thinking about that piece.
Do you mind just saying my name is June Reyes?
Oh, my name is June Reyes.
One more time.
Oh, my name is June Reyes.
Thank you. Sorry. That's a good
voice. Do you want me to say my name again? Did I say my name?
Let me just do it one more time.
Sure.
Just say.
My name is Jenny Chu. So I, you know, when we're talking about different APIs and Chinese Americans and immigrant, you know, Asians that have immigrated over and all the sort of differences, I also think about, I think it was Kyle upstairs on the panel, Kyle Weissman-Yee, that was talking about the difference between leadership can look many, many different ways. And I think about that in our own communities and what leadership looks like to Chinese Americans and how really protesting and how that was so different. And it was actually so alarming for me as someone that grew up in Oregon to see a whole entire Chinese community in the United States gather together for this one event for Peter Liang. It was like so shocking to me because I had never put politics and Chinese Americans in the same category in my sort of vision of what being an activist looked like. And I wonder about what activism is supposed to look like. And, I don't know if it's culturally specific or ethnically specific or what the context is, but to sort of figure out what that looks like authentically for us is an interesting thing to mull over.
I'm going to sit down for a moment.
My name is Megan Essler. I think there is a tradition of intercultural activism in this country. It's very, it may be almost invisible, but it was brought to my attention through a Google Doodle just the other day because it was honoring a Japanese-American woman. Did you happen to see that? Mm-hmm. And she, her name, you have her name?
No, I don't have it.
Yeah.
Yuriko
Shiyama. And she was incredible. I did the research and looked it up, and she got involved in the African American civil rights movement and devoted the rest of her life to that. And I think there are these models that that we need to be more aware of. And I actually was very glad that we had someone there from Oakland. My daughter lives in Oakland, and I have become more and more impressed with Oakland as a completely interesting mix of Latino, Asian, African American, white, I think doing a rather good job of trying to deal with gentrification and all kinds of issues. But I get a real feeling when I'm visiting my daughter that activism there is reaching across many different cultural norms. And of course, they have a lot of very new immigrants also who are new to this kind of activism. So I think there are some models out there.
Does anybody else have any other follow-up comments on anything discussed in the panel? If not, I have kind of a lengthy question, but so I'll talk about this. So at Apana, we talk and think about white supremacy as being a system that benefits white people at the expense of people of color, knowing, of course, that this looks really different for different communities of color within that group. And even within that, there are ways that we can uphold the system of white supremacy in our own communities. So faced with this system, we really have three different options. One, we can try to become a part of and benefit from that system, which may look like imitating or striving for whiteness, being more racist than the racist, that kind of a thing. Two, we can only look out for ourselves and our community of APIs, focusing only on the disparities that exist for our communities and how that impacts us personally. Or three, we can consciously choose to be part of resistance to the system and work toward liberation for all communities of color. So where do you see people making these choices around you? Like, is it pretty apparent? What informs those decisions? And what happens? What's the result?
So, talking about white supremacy and the notion, or not even the notion, but the reality that it's a social construct came to me very recently. I am 32 years old, and I have lived in Portland in the suburbs in Beaverton for all my life. And I had assimilated so well that I didn't have any Asian American models in Beaverton. I didn't have any friends. I think our table, even in 2000, there was a small group of APIs and then like three black kids. I mean, and it was like a sea of white. And so I think for me, it was partly survival. I mean, also allowing myself to be tokenized and just like, I'm the Asian girl, you know. It was all a sake of like trying to keep the peace and trying to reconcile the fact that I was very different, but also wanted to be a part of some greater social narrative. I was never not without friends, but you know, what kind of friends make fun of you? But they were my friends too. It wasn't all just making fun, you know, of me being Asian all the time. But, you know, and then there's also this sense of power too, right? Because when you're an other, you're also special. So for a very, very long time, I was really invisible to all of these structures. And then I think just recently, and even coming across articles and really learning about, you know, the 1882 Chinese Exclusionary Act, like just last year, which, you know, now it's 2016. I was 2015, which is ridiculous. You know, it's, I think about this, and I'm really just starting to enter a lot of this racial justice work recently, and like getting it very piecemeal, and like coming to talks like this. And I have a real difficulty trying to figure out what is productive and what. The sort of this idea, like I like thinking about it like social justice on the macro and empathy on the micro. So talking about, I don't know how to, I guess, reconcile positioning some people's opinions and feelings and experiences in this structure over other people's opinions and feelings and structures in the moment without feeling like we can't get to a place of empathy and peace if we don't carry all of it. And so, and I've seen time and time again, just through my recent experience, that people's individual humanities get reduced to the vernacular and language. And I don't know how to, you know, and I think it was Megan who was talking about Oakland and how they really try to get everyone involved. And I think in Portland, this work is so new that we're like huddling in our own little corners and we haven't really quite reached out yet. Like the bridges haven't really quite been built. And I think we're in this period where it's like we're trying to figure out how to build the bridges.
I just want to add that as I grew up, the elementary, middle school, and high school, there was always like a third African Americans, a third Asians, third white.
And you grew up in Seattle.
In Seattle, thank you. Yeah, I grew up in Seattle. But, and then all of a sudden I just started thinking, you know, am I Chinese American? Am I Chinese? Am I American Chinese? And that kind of sense, you know, who am I? In scheme of the whole society. And then I guess there's recently, I teach at PCC Southeast Campus. I teach ESOL, which is English for Speakers of the Languages. So there's the PCC mission is inclusion, diversity, and there's one more. But anyway, so there's been a great emphasis on that, as well as we've got various groups, affinity groups. One of them is for the white affinity group, and then I'm part of, it just started last year, which I helped organize, it's the faculty and staff of color. And so I just became more aware of this, white supremacy. And personally, I've encountered where, first of all, I said, okay, I've heard a comment, very racist, very stereotype. Do I feel comfortable to engage with this individual or group? So I would say, you know, what you said really hurts me. And it sounds like you're attacking me racially or stereotype, whatever. But I'm becoming more aware that we need to confront, and if you feel comfortable about the situation, confront individuals or groups and say, you know, that this is not right. You know, but going back, so finally, I think I've accepted it. I like to call myself as Chinese American. Yes.
I belong to a group called the Raging Grannies, and we're a bunch of older women who are mad and we're not going to take it anymore. And we've been working on hate language and our response to overhearing or to hearing hate language of various sorts and how you respond to it. Because, of course, the first non-confrontative thing that you want to do, especially as a woman, is to just, okay, everything's fine, just try to smooth it over. But that is, of course, not the right thing to do. And, I mean, there were an awful lot of women up there in that group, you know? this is definitely something that bothers women more, and I think because we can relate to it on several levels. So in our training, we actually went to a response to hate language training. You know, Trina, we actually practiced skits, because when you hear something, you don't have time, most of us don't have time to think up really good zingers. So we had little skits and little practice things to say. And I haven't yet had a chance to actually use one yet. I haven't heard anything yet, but, you know, I'm sure it's coming. And it won't necessarily change the world, but at least you won't be left, as we usually are, thinking, I should say something, and not knowing what to say. And also, of course, having some fear involved. It's scary situations, but I feel that there's some obligation to respond to remarks that you hear.
I'm going to edit the door, slam out. All right, did you want to?
Oh, sure.
Okay, I'm going to actually, is it okay if I sit here?
Oh, I'm sorry.
No worries.
Another thing that I'd like to say about dismantling white supremacy is also understanding, I think, your own complicity in the structure, and also noting that because it's such an invisible structure, that people aren't going to see it right away, and that it will always inherently seem like a personal attack. And to acknowledge that, and also to meet people, I think, if our purpose is simply, you know, is for change and to get people to understand that this is all a structure, that it's not entirely your fault, it's not entirely my fault, but we're all part of it. And addressing those moments with empathy and kindness and being like, listen, I know it's really hard. You're going to feel terrible. I know you're pissed at me. But just take a look at it. And I think that's really where addressing white supremacy for me has come from. And I always talk about, you know, I don't consider myself a capital A activist. I'd like to think, I like to, like, because I've been surrounded by white people in my life and I have a lot of white friends, I almost kind of feel like my work is one-on-one and in conversations. And I look at myself more like a social justice ninja. Like, I come in and I'm like, blah, 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 and they're like, you know, or they're like, I don't believe you. And then if anything, at least the nugget has been planted, which when I look at my own sort of dismantling of my own sort of shame and hate and racism of, like, being Asian American in a very white community, and that those nuggets were planted all along, and that it took, my whole journey probably took about 5 years of constantly feeling ashamed, you know, being in a city like San Francisco and feeling like the whitest Chinese person. But because I had really generous friends who were POCs, because there's more POCs in San Francisco, that they were really generous with me. Like, they would invite me to things that I felt very uncomfortable. You know, they would talk about white supremacy and racism, and I was like, I don't understand. But then all of a sudden, after 5 years, it clicked. So I think we have these conversations and we're exhausted by them, but we don't know what the nugget later on, when it will flower, like when the seed's planted, when it'll come out. So I think we have to look at every opportunity in dismantling white supremacy as progress, and to do what Megan said, which is essentially hold our ground and say something and resist in the ways that we feel comfortable.
Thank you.
Oh yeah, okay. So I've been thinking about how I've seen one problem where, okay, so I started my like social justice journey in college when I suddenly realized I wasn't white. I'm half white and half Chinese. And like where I grew up, it was mostly white, but also there were a lot of like people just like me, like half Chinese, half white too. And so I felt like I could basically like blend like an amphibian, and I could just like pass or do whatever. And I didn't think about it that much. And then when I came to school in Portland, it was very different. And I was suddenly like, my dean came up to me, who I didn't know, and like called me a person of color. And I was just like, what? So it was a whole realization that is still happening now. But something that I've seen a lot with my friends who have also started their journey and are also API, like they still really want to center themselves in that narrative. And it's like it's definitely a process, because of course we have to sort ourselves out, like Kyle said earlier at the panel, like have our own education before we decide to like be present or like make a lot of actual steps, I think, in different communities. But that's just hard, because there's also this tension I see with a lot of people, and I think it's true that there's a lot of silence around API struggles. And so it's kind of like finding that balance. I've really been torn between like centering other voices, but also saying, hey, I understand in some ways, like API people suffer or like, you know, experience similar things. And so I've found that to be a challenge too, is like finding, towing the line.
First one was, we can try to become part of and benefit from the system of white supremacy. The second one was that we can look at ourselves, our community of APIs, and only focus on ourselves and within our community and what hurts our community and what could benefit our community. And then the third one was we can consciously choose to be a part of resistance to that system of white supremacy and work toward liberation for all communities of color. I think just thinking about which of those three pathways do you see play out in your lives most often, and why do you think that is?
This is such an...
You're life-saving. My legs are getting really tired.
This is a really easy answer for me, and I think it's different depending on what social context you're in. So I feel like when I'm around APANO members and on 82nd and Powell, like I feel like the API community is very prevalent and very visible and active. But in my daily life, and because I work downtown at an arts nonprofit and grew up in the suburbs, I feel like there's a lot of people that just resign to benefiting from white supremacy or assimilating and working the system. So Asian Americans, we've certainly benefited from being a model minority. Like, people think I'm really smart just because I'm Asian, which I'm like, you don't have no idea how not smart I am. But anyways, You know, so there's I think it's much easier. It's the path of least resistance. And when you think about all sorts of different, like the intersectionality of identity politics and how, I'm not even going to, never mind. I'm going to bring something else totally out and then it's like going to open up the floodgates. I was going to talk about the queer community. But, you know, when we think about the path of least resistance and what's normal and what's normalized, there's also this sense too, I feel like a lot of POCs that have benefited, or not benefited, but have gotten jobs, oftentimes reconcile in their minds emotionally, and I know I've done this, where you're almost so thankful. You're like, oh, I got hired. Oh, I'm part of this organization. Oh, and then you start looking a little deeper and you're like, oh, I'm an assistant. Oh, I like work really long hours. Okay, you know, and then there is this, like, there's nothing wrong. And it's much more difficult, I think, to fight the fight every day and to be constantly looking at your own intent and what your impact is, and to look at your own complicity as a person of color, perpetuating the system that keeps, that is oppressive to all different, to everybody. So for me, I see more people, I think, just being complicit.
Can I ask you a follow-up?
Sure.
You mentioned people sort of resigning themselves or being complicit. What does resigning yourself look like in your own life, in your own context?
I mean, I think resigning looks a lot like, for me personally, just thinking back as being an Asian American woman, allowing myself to be tokenized, allowing myself to be sexualized, allowing myself to be exoticized. In some really gross ways, I also know that I have been given access to many white spaces, many privileged white spaces, because I was probably an Asian American woman and not an Asian man. You know, just the differences between that. And I have a little brother, and there's this amazing book actually by Alex Tizan called Big Little Man that won the Oregon Book Award in Creative Nonfiction, I think in 2014, that talks about the Asian American male experience in the United States. And he touches upon being an Asian American woman too. And he talks about it, they're not comparative, but being completely invisible as an Asian American man in the sort of social sphere, which sex in general is power, right? So when Asian American women tend to be sexualized as either a sexual nymph or like the super bookish smart person, right? And to be exoticized in some ways is better and can be utilized as power. I don't know what kind of power, but it's like compared to being invisible. So I think the sort of path of least resistance and assimilating, oftentimes I think for me, looked a lot like, you know, the Japanese cartoons where like little Japanese anime cards are like laughing, like, hee hee hee, that was really funny. But actually I feel really objectified right now. And I'm just going to laugh this joke off and I'm going to move about and make you feel like that was a really funny joke when it really wasn't a funny joke. And I also think that it all also looks like, you know, taking jobs that you, I don't know. I mean, yeah. Does that answer your question?
The first one was what? What was the first one? Compliance?
Yes, it is. Okay. So basically, just becoming part of the system and also benefiting from white supremacy.
Well, I don't know about the last part, benefiting, but maybe. But see, when I grew up, very typical Chinese family, my parents said, you respect your teachers, you know, you don't cause any problems, we want to see your good grades, and then when you finish, you're going to college. There was no discussion. And so, yeah, I grew up that way, just being compliant, and yes, 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 yes. And I think that also fell into, it reinforced the stereotype of Chinese, Japanese, you know, you're quiet, you're a hard worker, you're academically great, actually I wasn't that great, but so I think that what I see myself is the third point, but resistance is not what I'm looking at. What I'm looking at is more or less social justice changes, where, you know, where I think that with my intervention or, you know, discussions with white counterparts, colleagues, whoever, that I'm hoping that there'll be changes. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be a long, long road, but it is going to get there. Mm-hmm. Because I think that if all of us APIs, you know, look at it and say, okay, we got to make these changes of white supremacy, and there's different ways of doing it.
So I think about the spaces that I've been in, and nonprofits that I've been that I know, and thinking about how a lot of requirements, there are requirements now to get funding, for example, that you have sort of this diversity, equity, inclusion kind of analysis, you have a statement. And so sometimes I feel torn because I know that we're getting, you know, this means that, okay, we were pushing people in sort of this direction to have this racial, you know, this kind of equity lens, and maybe it's a racial equity focus, but then it's also become a business case. And so that's kind of where I get kind of torn because, you know, this is how we get people on board. But, you know, there's such a big moral imperative there that when it becomes used as a business case, because it's like, hey, you know, 2042, we're going to have majority of people in the U.S. are not going to be white. And so, you know, we need to be able to reach out to people because those are going to be the populations we're serving. But does that really do justice to the system that we're trying to change? And so when I think about this question of complicity and sort of, you know, what you were talking about, like a social justice change, a system change versus, you know, maybe it's not a versus kind of question to resistance, but, you know, how do we even make that leap from after having sort of this nudge for the, okay, we're going to get some funding this way once we have a DEI statement, to actually, okay, well, does that in line with changing the system? And if we can make that an easy move to go from that place to the other one.
Yeah, that brought up something for me that I have a really similar parallel because I just graduated from Lewis and Clark, and there's a lot of social movements there. And like I said, I started my journey there, and so I was really vigilant. I attended, like, you know, I've been working on it consistently for the whole time I was there. And when, like, a certain incident broke out that sparked a lot of attention and, outrage from our students, I saw a similar kind of, like, not tokenizing, but kind of, like, it's cool to be interested in social justice for a lot of, like, incoming students. And so, like, there was a lot of sudden participation when people hadn't done, like, the understanding where they are positioned in white supremacy or in our society in, like, all sectors. And so that was really hard. And, like, I ended up feeling really, like, self-righteous and, like, oh, I'm the one who's been working so hard, and now all these randos are coming in and, like, taking the microphone, you know, at our protests and stuff. Or I felt like one day we had, like, a sit-in and people didn't attend class, and I was, like, appalled because there was no kind of discussion or meaningful resources or reflection about what was going on, and it seemed like people were just wanting to skip class and, like, be seen at a protest. And so, like, I got really upset, but then I realized, like, but social justice is about inclusion and opening the door. Like, if I'm going to be defensive and yelling at people for not understanding things that have been invisible to them, then it's a big barrier. And so that was a big realization for me. And even if, like you said, June, that it's a business imperative or some or other motivation, yeah, it's like we would still take it over apathy or complicit compliance.
I'd also like to add that for some people, social justice, the rationale for it needs to come from someplace. So whether it's the cool factor in colleges to be at a protest rally, or whether it's like the business case for nonprofits or for-profits or for the tech world, you know, because all the higher level skill, employees that are coming are like all POCs from like out of the country, from different countries. I don't know. You know, I think it's important to sort of influx in like the idea that I think when we look at urban centers like San Francisco or New York, or like other places that have like very high concentrations of diversity and different ethnic and sociocultural populations living together, they get that chance to rub up against each other and like have relationships with each other and see each other's faces, and people's kids start going to school, and then they have those real relationships, and then they don't need to have these like, you know, protest rallies about racial justice, because those human relationships have been built. Because, you know, and I think, I don't know, like that might be really idealistic, but I think the sort of business case sometimes can have, I mean, it's a starting point, and like I think we should always be critical of people's intentions in this work, because we also have to be critical of our own motivations of why we're doing this as well, and how we're doing it. But like, let's say I read this, I think the BBC released, was it the BBC? They released their like equity, diversity, and inclusion statement. It was like a 5-year plan or something. And it was incredible. And it was really extensive. And they were doing some really, what seemed to me like very radical, basically parity, counting heads, talking about, you know, percentages of POCs. And then at the end, they're like, we know that this is just a starting point, but we hope eventually that we won't even have to think about these structures anymore, because it'll just be diverse and inclusive.
What is that?
This is, sounds like an elevator.
Can you pick that up?
Yes.
Yeah. pick anything up.
Yeah, it kind of depends, you know, like if it's...
I was so enraged, so angry.
Sorry, could you start again and say when it happened?
Oh, sorry. No, you don't need to take, that's not part of this, right?
I think it's interesting.
Oh.
If you'd rather not, I understand. Oh, I just think okay. It's interesting to think about and talk about, because it was also...
That wasn't connected to the panel, right. Sort of speak. Okay, no, when the incident with Peter Lang occurred, I was very angry. First of all, and I'm saying this because I've been keeping this inside, with the exception of a couple of people I've talked with. But first of all, why did they send two rookies? You know, usually it makes common sense that you say one experience and then Peter, who's a rookie. And the fact also, too, is that I'm really happy that the Judge Chun decreased his sentence instead of manslaughter. And I was thinking, what would happen if the cop who killed Gurley was African-American? What would be the reaction of the community, the African-American community? And then also, too, how many white cops have not been indicted that have, you know, done various things, you know, and shot or killed or whatever? So I guess that part really, really bothers me. So what comes to my mind is that whole social justice, the system, is very abusive, yeah. And very racist, very stereotype, and that needs to be changed. Mm-hmm. So thank you for allowing me to get all that out.
Of course.
Did you want to say something?
Yeah.
As long as I'm here, I hope you're
Really quick, though. So one thought I had during the panel was just we kind of didn't talk about the fact that the prison industrial complex and the fact that, like, we're celebrating that someone, or, you know, we're mad someone isn't going to prison, and just thinking about that in general. Like, I know similarly with the Brock Turner, is that his name? The Stanford swimmer who got on a lenient sentence for sexual assault, people are like, he should be, like, it's bad that he was an exception and he's not going to prison, but just thinking about the implications of demanding this kind of punishment that we know is a systemic problem, and in general, just, like, it's probably, I don't know, in my opinion, I think that we should not celebrate people, or, no, we should not criticize, no, I don't know, never mind, just that, yeah, we should acknowledge that it's also a specific act when we say someone should go to prison for longer.